Well, good morning, Liminal Church. And Wayne, thank you. Thank you for those nice words. So as Wayne just said, we have a teaching team here. So instead of just one person, you get a variety. And each of us speaks out of our own personalities, out of our own strengths, out of our own weaknesses. And we bring our preferences into our messages a lot. Catherine's love for history, Wayne's love for the Enneagram, Jeremy's love for punk rock. But sometimes things overlap. And that's what we have this morning. I, too, am a Tolkien lover, and I take regular pilgrimages through his works, from the Shire to Lothlorien to Mordor and back. And so I wanted to start out today with a clip from Fellowship of the Ring, just to start us off.
You have only one choice. The ring must be destroyed.
What are we waiting for?
The ring cannot be destroyed, Gimli, son of Gloin, by any craft that we here possess. The ring was made in the fires of Mount Doom. Only there can it be unmade. It must be taken deep into Mordor and cast back into the fiery chasm from whence it came. One of you must do this.
One does not simply walk into Mordor. Its black gates are guarded by more than just orcs. There is evil there that does not sleep. The great eye is ever watchful. It is a barren wasteland, riddled with fire and ash and dust. The very air you breathe is a poisonous fume. Not with 10,000 men could you do this. It is folly.
Have you heard nothing Lord Elrond has said? The ring must be destroyed.
And I suppose you think you're the one to do it.
And if we fail, what then? What happens when Sauron takes back what is his?
I will be dead before I see the ring in the hands of an elf!
I will take the ring to Mordor. Though I do not know the way.
You know, the first time I saw that, Peter Jackson's masterful interpretation of the Council of Elrond, something occurred to me. I looked at the reflection in the ring of the various groups arguing about who should be entrusted with the one ring, and I thought, this is the church. And when I say the church, I mean the church over the centuries. I don't mean just liminal, although I'm sure we have our piece in it. Because from the very beginning of Christianity, there's been a struggle of who has the handle on the one true way. And who wields the power. Most of you were here during our sermon, or some of you were here on our sermon series on Shalom, where we looked at the way of Shalom versus the way of empire. And we can see that same struggle plastered across every news headline now. can't we? The church, for decades struggling with having been seen as becoming irrelevant, became a battleground for holding on to the old ways or doing things differently. It's said the seven last words of the church are, "We've never done it that way before." Because change is scary. And who knows what babies you're throwing out with the bathwater, so you better not mess with the status quo. And the church is held to that, to its detriment. This struggle is not new. In fact, it renews itself with every generation. Struggles to find an expression of faith that is theirs opposed to that of their parents, their forefathers. In my lifetime, we saw that happen in the 60s and 70s with the Jesus movement, when the church struggled whether or not to let these long-haired, barefoot radicals through their doors. We see it now through what many call deconstruction. Well, that's the background. And here we are in a series on mystics and saints. We've talked about a couple of mystics already, but today I want to take a look at a saint, one of my favorites. And it's easy to think of saints as old and moldy and to view them with Protestant skepticism. The Catholic Church has made quite a process of deciding who is a saint and who is not. And to be honest with you, despite my love for the Catholic Church, or some of it anyway, some of their criteria seem sort of magic thinking to me. And so honestly, some of the saints are saints because it was politically or economically expedient for them to be canonized. That being said, most of the more familiar ones had something going for them. Apart from the canonization process, an authentic faith and a love for God that stood out amongst their peers. The thing to remember about saints is they were real people. People not unlike you and me. For many of them, their saintly behavior was born out of failure, out of trial, out of lots of error, and out of sin. Most of them could write volumes and volumes about what does not work and how not to have a life of faith. And most of them would have been shocked to find themselves candidates for sainthood. And so it was with Ignatius of Loyola, who is our saint du jour. During the lifetime of Ignatius of Loyola, who was born in 1491 and died in 1556, the Catholic Church was in crisis. It was facing rampant internal corruption, declining credibility, and rapid defection of its members due to the Protestant Reformation. The church was largely stagnant and definitely in need of reform, leading to the Counter-Reformation, the Council of Trent, and founding of new orders such as the Jesuits. So some of the key historic movements that were happening during Ignatius's life were, as I said, the Protestant Reformation, where the church was reeling from a loss of influence due to reformers like Martin Luther, which sparked a need for a massive renewed spiritual effort. There was the Counter-Reformation, or the Catholic Reformation, and this movement aimed to reform the church from within. Ignatius and his newly found formed Society of Jesus, or the Jesuits, which was approved in 1540, became key intellectual and missionary force in this effort. The Spanish Inquisition was going on. Now, it had begun early in the 1400s, but it was still very active in Spain during Ignatius's lifetime. And the Spanish Inquisition was really bent on keeping the status quo. And so they were questioning anything new, and Ignatius's fervent spiritual movement certainly hit their radar, which landed him in jail a couple times, accused of heresy. And fortunately, he was found not guilty. There was an educational and missionary focus to combat the ignorance among the clergy and the faithful. The newly formed Jesuit order focused on education. They felt like it was good for the congregation to know and understand what this thing the Bible had to say, and that it should not only be interpreted by priests, it should be accessible to all. Well, this began to spread like wildfire. And it also dovetailed, unfortunately, with the plots and plans of political leaders as the Jesuits went forth into missionary ventures, into new worlds such as Asia. The powers that be saw that as an inroad where they could expand their empire. So they became unwitting, uneasy, and in some cases, very unwilling bedfellows. It led to a spiritual revival. Now, Ignatius was intent on reforming the Catholic Church from within. He loved the Catholic Church. And he began the spiritual exercises, which is something that he began as his own devotional. And it spread from one person to five people to seven people and began to spread there as a structured personal way for people to renew their faith and their commitment to the church and reforming it from the one to the many. The Council of Trent also took place towards the end of Ignatius's life. The beginnings of it happened earlier, but this council addressed internal corruption, clarified doctrine in the Catholic Church, and initiated a new culture of Catholic reform. Now, Ignatius's work provided the missionary fire the church desperately needed to bring faith back to a divided Europe and to new lands. There are some significant historical figures, which I'm sure you will be familiar with in some shape or form. These political leaders were Charles V, who was the ruler of the Holy Roman Empire from 1519, and also the Spanish Empire, which controlled vast European American territories. There was Henry VIII, Tudor King of England, who initiated the English Reformation for all the wrong reasons, named Anne. There was Niccolo Machiavelli, a Florentine diplomat and political philosopher who wrote The Prince and promoted fear as a device for control, for the stability of the state, he said. His name became synonymous with cunning, deceit, and ruthless manipulation to gain power and achieve personal goals. There were religious reformers, Martin Luther, who initiated the Protestant Reformation by questioning the Catholic Church traditions and excesses. There was Erasmus, who was a Northern European scholar who defined humanism. Then there were the artists and intellectuals. We've got Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Copernicus, the explorers, many, but the ones I'll bring out today are Vespucci and Columbus. I believe you've heard of him. Sailed the ocean blue in 1492. So it was a rich time of change. There was a lot going on. The church was in crisis. The world was in conflict. There was rapidly changing ideas in terms of philosophy, science, the universe, and God. Sounds a bit familiar, doesn't it? So where does Ignatius fit into all of this? Rather than join with Martin Luther in his repudiation of the Catholic Church and its excesses and corruption, Ignatius chose to remain Catholic and reform from within. He was, in fact, one of the central figures of the Counter-Reformation along with his follower, Francis Xavier. But reforming from within came to mean something different to Ignatius than that others may have missed. Ignatius recognized that reforming an institution began with reforming the individuals that made up the institution. In fact, it began with him, and then with a ragtag bunch of followers. And this brought him on a journey that was what inspired me to begin this message with a clip from Fellowship of the Ring. Ignatius, a nobleman, a scholar, who was coincidentally 5'2" in height, so he was a little guy, found himself answering God's call, much as Frodo answered Eldron's. I will take up this mission, although I do not know the way. And like Frodo, Ignatius did a lot of wandering. His conversion began in a rather inauspicious way. He was shot in the leg by a cannon. Now, we all think of Paul's conversion as something rather dramatic. I think I'd rather fall off a donkey than I would being shot by a cannon. But it worked in Ignatius's way. So after the rudimentary efforts of a physician led to his leg being worse off than it was before, he underwent surgery. Now, can you imagine surgery in the 1400s? not a whole lot of medical knowledge of sanitation or pain management. So his recuperation took over a year. And during this time, he took refuge in a nobleman's castle. And he was desperately bored. He loved tales of knights in shining armor and the romance of all of that. And that actually was his goal in life at the time. He wanted to be one of those guys. But the nobleman whose house it was a devout fellow. And the only books he had were either the lives of saints or the Bible. So desperate was Ignatius for something to read that he made his way through both sets of volumes. And there, in his infirmed state, he had a rather interesting conversion experience. Upon being released and his leg was somewhat mended, Ignatius gave up his former life as a spoiled upper-class lad with delusions of grandeur and went in the opposite direction entirely. In fact, he spent a lengthy time in a cave near Manresa, where he attended to his soul, where he was shown through visions and prayer what was lacking in his own life and spirituality, and where he surrendered his life, his comfort, and his dreams of glory to answer the bidding of God. Now, I could go on and on about Ignatius's life, but I'm told there's a game this afternoon. Well, there's games here, and then there's the game, but I'm told it's also at 3:30. So, you know, I've got some time. I wanted to center on a few things that Ignatius practiced and taught as part of his spiritual exercises. A handbook for retreatants that is still experienced today. In fact, there's some in this room who've gone through a form of the exercises, the 19th annotation. I think Joyce has, yeah? Yep, and I have, and there may be others. And I think we would tell you that it's a very profound and life-changing experience. I would put it in one of the top three things that I've done in my spiritual life that have really informed who I am and what I believe. So here, very briefly, are some key aspects of Ignatius of Loyola's teachings. And I'm going to try to relate them to where we are today. So some of the core principles and values are these. Humans are created to praise, love, and serve God. All other things are gifts to help us achieve this, and we must use them in balance, detaching from anything that hinders this purpose. There's what he called magis, or more, and that has to do with motivation. So fueled by a restless desire for depth in spirituality, we are to strive for excellence and greater good, not for its own sake, but for the glory of God. There's cura personalis. We value and nurture the unique spiritual and intellectual and emotional growth of each individual, recognizing that each and everyone is loved by God. There's ad majorem Dei gloriam, and pardon my Latin accent. I am told that anything I speak other than English, and possibly even English, comes with an appalling accent. I've been laughed at all my life, so feel free. It will not hurt me. It's been done before. Ad majorem del gloriam. We endeavor to view all actions, even mundane ones, as opportunities to give glory to God. Finding God in all things. We recognize God's presence in action, not just in religious settings, but in everyday life, nature, and experience. Not a bad list of tenets. And I bet a few of you are surprised, thinking that we made up these things. We did not. Well, as I said, Ignatius of Loyola is one of my favorites. I love the bumpy road that his journey took, and I love his persistence. I love that he was not willing to compromise his passions and surrender to the status quo. And I love the things he believed would be helpful to future sojourners along the path, and they're still being taught today. I think you'd be surprised about that. Here are some of the key practices and attitudes of the spiritual exercises, which this morning I'm going to call the gifts of Ignatius. First of all, there's the examine prayer. This is a daily prayer of reflection to become aware of God's presence in and through your day, to receive all with gratitude, to notice what emotions you encountered through it all, and to look toward the next day. Now, somewhere along the line, it occurred to Ignatius that we are all easily distracted as human beings. And if you doubt this, try centering prayer for 15 minutes. Okay, try it for 5. No sooner do you sit down to meditate on the goodness of God, but your mind takes on a mind of its own, as it were, and you become bombarded by a gazillion things that you have to do, random thoughts, musings, muddlings, whatever, anything but God. In fact, you'll be drawn to think about pretty much anything other than what you sat down to think about. Those in the spiritual transformation universe kind of call that monkey mind. Ignatius recognized the same failings in humanity and came up with a spiritual exercise to address it, and it's called the prayer of examine. Now, if you've been around here long and you've heard me teach on this before, I usually complain that the prayer of examine is kind of taught poorly. It tends to take on the flavor of one being called into the principal's office to go over all the things you've done wrong. That is so far from what Ignatius had in mind. Rather, picture this. The prayer of examine takes kind of the form of a beloved child meeting with a loving grandparent who scoops the wiggling little one up into a welcoming lap and says, "How was your day, love? Can you tell me about it? Where did you feel especially close to God today? Where did you wish you felt God's presence, but you didn't?" It's a very gentle prayer, a loving one that allows you to explore your day in the lap of grace. And the purpose of the examine is not to show you how you failed. It's to encourage you to notice the movements of God in your day. When things trigger you, what recurring habits are not helpful to you, things that are so easy to miss and to allow to go unnoticed. Because you can't really be close and have a close relationship with God, one that is transformative, if you don't sense God's presence, right? You end up just sort of going through the motions, and there's no substance that's going to sustain you when the going gets tough. Prayer of examine. If you're not familiar with it and you want more on it, let me know. I'll pop you an email. I love to send things around like that. Okay, so moving on to the second gift, and that is discernment. Ignatius defined a conscious process of decision-making using reason, imagination, and prayer to understand God's will. He recognized that in order for the church to be transformed, and in order for those within the church to be transformed, the foundations on which they had built their faith and made their decisions needed to be completely reworked. An early deconstruction, if you will. And he taught that what we call deconstruction, evaluating of our faith to see what is real and what is not, to open ourselves to the notion that some of our dearly held beliefs may be traditions rather than truth, to remain in a humble state of continual confession, conversion, and transformation is a never-ending process. It's not a one-off. You don't confess, say the prayer, and then you go on living your own way. That's not how it works. Oh, if someone had told me that in my 20s. Oh, well. Ignatius realized the truth of Isaiah 55:8-9, and that says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." Now, I have some thoughts about this, and this little bit is Jenny, not Ignatius. So if you don't like it, don't blame him. In the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve ate the apple with the idea of becoming like God, which doesn't sound like an all bad thing, they ate the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But there was a small problem. See, when God discerns the difference between good and evil, he based it on a completely different paradigm than we are capable of having. So when we discern the difference, we're basing it on the faulty assumption that we have a clue what good and evil are. And our preconceptions are stained by our own biases and our own egos. And that causes all sorts of problems. We assume that we know what constitutes the worth of a person, what constitutes beauty or ugliness, what constitutes sin or righteousness, what even constitutes the truth. And then we grab those standards, codify them, and pronounce anyone not fitting into that mold as bad, evil, or unworthy. That's a big problem. Maybe you have it. Maybe you don't. Let's give it a test. So, everybody shut your eyes. We have the doors barred. No one may leave. Imagine with me for a moment that you woke up this morning and you had a cup of coffee or tea and you opened the newspaper. Okay, let's imagine we live in a world with newspapers. Humor me. And on the front page of the newspaper, you see the face of someone who's in the news a lot. And in fact, the very glimpse of this face makes your skin crawl. Just for a moment, sit with that visceral reaction. The reaction of seeing that face. Now look at the face again. And as you do so, imagine that God notices you and he places his hand on your shoulder. But you also see that at the same time, he's placing his hand on the shoulder of that one that caused such a visceral reaction. And God says this, "But I, with the unfathomable richness of my love and mercy, focus on you. I unite you both with the Anointed One and infuse your lifeless souls with life. Even though you were buried under mountains of sin, I have saved you by my grace." See, when God says to pray for and love your enemies, he's not asking you to see them as he does, or just ask you to do that with loving compassion and grace. You don't have to love what the person is doing or saying, and you don't have to agree with it. In fact, at times you may need to actively stand against it, but never forget that that person carries the same spark of God in him or her that you carry in yourself, whether you see it or not. So do you need a second to recover from that? Sorry. Let's take a few breaths. We do not think like God thinks. Because God loves all of us, even that guy or that woman or your next door neighbor and its barking dog. One of the things that Ignatius is most well known for is finding God in all things, finding God in all people. This is the cornerstone of Ignatian spirituality. It's rooted in Ignatius's conviction that the divine is active, present, and accessible in every moment, place, and creature, not just in church. He recognized the vastness, the incomprehensibility of God. And from there, he also recognized the presence of God in the moment. In fact, Ignatius began to see the presence of God in everyone and everything. Sometimes we have to look pretty hard to find it. But I think God loves it when we try. I really think he does. And Ignatius recognizes this fact. He realized we have to find a better way of discernment than our own faulty understandings. And here's what he came up with. Two words that, in the words of Inigo Montoya, do not mean what you think they mean. Consolation and desolation. As part of Ignatius's daily regime, he would look at the events of the day, and he'd assign them into two categories, consolation and desolation. Now, the problem here is we tend to think of consolation as the good stuff, the stuff that gives us pleasure, benefits us in some way, and desolation is just the opposite. But imagine along with me, and I promise this one will be quite as intense as the last, imagine you were given a lottery ticket, and lo and behold, this lottery ticket is worth $10 million. Good thing, right? Yeah? You're happy. Maybe ecstatic. Because now you can pay off all your bills. You can give a nominal chunk to the church, of course. And of course, help out your family, you know, help them pay off their debts, pay off their school loans, maybe buy the new sports car you wanted and a bigger house, of course, sure. And pretty soon, you don't remember your dependence on God at all because you don't really have a need for him. You've got $10 million or a little less now because you spent sitting in your bank account, ready to be your life net when you need it. Or, and I need to do a caveat here because I realize there's a whole bunch of reasons why people get into financial difficulties. For this particular example, I'm imagining that it was profligate spending, but that is a very small reason why you may be feeling a pinch. So don't take any condemnation from that, please, because I've been there, trust me. So imagine that you wish that you had gotten that winning lottery ticket because you're deep in debt and your spending is out of control and you're in danger of having your car repossessed. And you realize in this particular case that it is your habits that have gotten you where you are. Imagine that you're going for a walk, and along the walk you sense the presence of God, and you pour out your heart to him, telling him your desperation. And imagine that you feel a gentle tap on your shoulder, and you recognize it as God's touch and an invitation to change your ways. You're overcome by a sense of his presence and his love. And that gives you the motivation and the ability to make some changes that will help you get out of debt. Through the process, which takes time, of course, you grow in your sense of responsibility, your understanding of your dependence on God from moment to moment, and a gratitude for what you have, and even a generosity towards others who lack more than you. Which of the two scenarios is a consolation? The lottery ticket? Or the debt. In Ignatius's eyes, consolations are things that draw you towards God. So in the scenarios above, it is actually the financial difficulties that become the catalyst for the person reconnecting with God and surrendering his or her habits and excesses to God, which paved the way for recovery and freedom. And in the other scenario, it was actually the winning lottery ticket and the resulting millions that served to distract the person from God and, in fact, led the person to feel like they didn't really need God at all, that they had everything they could possibly need. See how it works? Consolations draw you towards God. Desolations distract you. Unless desolations left to their own devices can actually become consolations. Kind of fun, if you let them. How, you ask? Well, they offer an invitation to see what doesn't work. Imagine the story of the prodigal son. The kid asks his father for his inheritance so he can go live a life of luxury in the fast lane. And the father acquiesced. The kid found out the hard way that the inheritance didn't last forever. In fact, he ran out of money, ended up living off the slop in the pigs that he was forced to tend. And he had a moment of clarity there in the pig trough where he thought, I should return to my father. Even his pigs eat better than these. So he did, and he asked for forgiveness, and of course he was restored. You know the story. His desolation was turned to consolation. There in the pig trough, he had a moment of clarity that led him to freedom. The fourth gift of Ignatius, and I should say here that there are so many more gifts from my favorite saint, but Catherine, who is another favorite saint of mine, mentions it if we go too long on our teachings. And I think she actually is planning on watching the Super Bowl this afternoon, so I should end somewhere before 3:30. This is interior freedom. That's developing a detachment from disordered attachment to things, people, or ideas that prevent us from loving and serving God. This speaks of our priorities, a clearing out of our hearts, our minds, and our lives of things that distract, that have a hold on us. When the going gets tough, what do you run to? Numbing yourself in front of the TV? Shopping? Eating? Drinking? Drugs? I don't know. Look, none of these things are, well, maybe the drugs. Okay, most of these things are not evil within themselves. And even drugs. I mean, you know, if properly used, they're fine. When you want to watch a program on TV, watch it. When you're hungry, eat. When you want something to drink that's fun and fizzy, do it. But ask yourself why. Why are you doing this? What are you really longing for that you think a new sweater or a martini will fix? Because it probably won't. And with any of these examples, once you dive headlong into a substitute fix, or as Ignatius would call it, your disordered attachment, it owns you. You've got two problems now, the original one and the dependency on the fix that it's being created. Disordered attachments. It's good to find out what yours are. Mine are shopping and eating. So I have learned when I'm stressed, I don't go to the mall. It becomes very expensive. When I'm stressed, I don't go to the refrigerator because you can trust me, I'm not going to come away with an apple. So the last two gifts center on how we should be in the world. The first one is contemplation in action. Bringing a prayerful, reflective mindset to active, busy life, not separating prayer from daily responsibilities. Now, for those of you who follow Richard Rohr, this phrase may be very familiar, contemplation in action. I think that's what he calls his website. For Rohr, for Ignatius, and for many of the saints and mystics, there's no distinction between sacred and secular. When Scripture speaks of praying at all times, in Ignatius's mind, that did not mean closing oneself off from the world. Yes, he began his prayer and his practices in a cave. Okay, we're just going to ignore that, if we can. So he began his prayer practices in a cave, right? But there came a time when he was invited out of the cave and into the world, with the idea of becoming some earthly good in it. And he was able to bring his habit of remaining in the attitude of prayer into whatever he did. The notion of being holy on Sunday and living Monday through Saturday, however the hell we want to, doesn't work. You end up being shallow on Sunday and feeling guilty or unfulfilled the rest of the week. Yes, I said hell in a sermon. I can get worse, trust me. Our bodies are somewhat Trinitarian. We have a body, we have a mind, we have a spirit, or a soul if you wish. These three aspects are all stuck together in one lump called us. We can no more sever our minds from our bodies and allow them to work independently of one another than we could sprout wings and fly. I am one body made up of several parts that cannot be separated from who I am as a whole. And when my life runs counter to that reality, there's a disconnect. which, to be honest, there usually is. Goodness. Okay. Because right now my body wants to go out there and punch someone. Yes, I am your pastor. My body wants to do one thing. My mind wants to do another. My soul cries out for a third. Do any of you remember the push me, pull you from Dr. Doolittle? Now imagine it had three heads instead of two. What a mess, right? Ignatius's answer to that difficulty is contemplation in action. And this means we are bringing a prayerful, reflective mindset into our active, busy life. Not separating prayer from our daily responsibilities, but rather allowing them to blend and harmonize together. The Jewish High Holy Prayer, the Shema, puts it like this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. In other words, this stuff that we hold as true, it should be part of everything we are. This is an invitation, okay, really more of a command, to live in a state of contemplation in action, of living as fully integrated human beings, where body, mind, and spirit, or soul, work together as one, rather than work against each other, like the push me, pull you, pull you. Then we have service and justice, a call to be men and women for others, promoting justice and working for the common good. Jesus, when asked what was the most important law, quoted the Shema, but added a little bit to the end from Leviticus. Someone asked him, "Teacher, what is the greatest commandment of the law?" And Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind." That's the whole of us, right? This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. The second part is Jesus calling us out of the cave. He's saying it's not enough just to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And I put that in quotes because I know just how hard that is. But it's not enough. He wants us to be image bearers, bringing his light into the world, which means two things. First of all, be out in the world. And second, reflect Jesus when you're out there. Be his image bearer. And that means changing some of the ways we do things, say things, changing the way we are. Doesn't it? Well, that's a bit of what Ignatius thought and what, in fact, Ignatius did, which is why we're still learning from him today. And I hope you are intrigued or inspired or even that it made you a bit angry. I hope it made you feel something, because slip-sliding through our normal path is not cutting it in terms of being the light into the world. And while the job seems too daunting, and where we too may say, "I'll take the burden, but I do not know the way," the state of our world these days illustrates the necessity of our taking a stand, to clean our own houses, to take care of our own inner woundedness. We do not have the luxury of remaining in woundedness. We must seek be healed. We cannot be the light of the world if we are focused on that. We must clean our own houses. We must attend to our own interior freedom. And we must require of our religious institutions that they do the same. We must stand up for what is right and what is good in God's eyes, not just ours. And then, in the overused, misattributed, and decidedly unimplemented words of someone who is probably not Mahatma Gandhi, be the change you want to see in the world. Now, I know that's on everybody's refrigerator, but what if we all did it? Well, I'm going to invite the band up. And today, as our habit, on the second and last Sundays of the month, we will celebrate communion together. And I hope that today, as we take communion, we can practice something that I preached this morning. And that is to hold our focus on what we're doing. When the disciples took the bread and wine from Jesus' hand, he was asking something of them. And that was echoed later in the gospel when he met with Peter after Peter denied him three times. Jesus is asking, do you love me? Do you? Do you really? And if so, feed my lambs. Be me in the world while I am absent in bodily form. And of course, the disciples said yes, and then immediately ran into the same thing we run into. Fear, yes, but more distractions. So when we come forward for communion, the band is going to sing Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, which is a favorite old hymn of mine, written by Robert Robertson. Now, if you were here last week, Andrew told us of Annie Dillard's experience observing a creek, likening it to the inexhaustible and never-ending grace of God. I'd like to read the words of a few of the verses to you as a closing prayer. Then the band will sing it over us as you come forward to receive your grace in the form of a cracker and juice. Come, thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace. Imagine a guitar out of tune. Imagine the guitarist changing the peg just a little to make it a little tighter or a little looser until it's in tune with its neighbors. Streams of mercy never ceasing call for songs of loudest praise. Teach me some melodious sonnet sung by flaming tongues above. Praise the mount, I'm fixed upon it, the mount of thy redeeming love. O, to grace, how great a debtor daily I'm constrained to be. Let that grace, now like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, oh Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, Lord. Take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. You can come forward for communion when we're ready.